Coming up on the program today, legislative economics, a possible preview of the jobs report, and candy, big candy, from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Wednesday, March 8th. Good as always to have you here, everybody. We begin today with two economic points of view, one statistical, one anecdotal. Statistics first, because, of course, the private payroll processing company ADP came out with its best guess at the February jobs figures today. The company says private businesses in this economy added 298,000 jobs last month, which is, technically speaking, a boatload, and much more than had been expected. Item two is the anecdotal response from White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer when he was asked about the economy at his briefing today.
We see a resurgence in optimism in the economy by job creators to want to hire here, who want to manufacture here, who want to grow here.
You can't blame the White House for taking credit, especially when more than 100,000 of those new hires that ADP was talking about were made by small businesses, not the biggies who hire in huge numbers. Marketplace's Andy Euler looks at what those numbers might be telling us.
You'd be hard-pressed to find an economist who will tell you that the environment for small businesses is a bad one right now. Bill Dunkelberg certainly won't. He's chief economist at the National Federation of Independent Business. He says this is the most optimistic he's seen firms he's in touch with in more than 40 years.
These numbers are really good, and we're hoping that they translate into hiring and spending and all those good things that will make the economy grow a little bit faster.
So why are businesses feeling so optimistic? Well, for one, the economy was chugging along nicely before the presidential election. Aparna Mathur, an economist at the American Enterprise Institute, says companies are betting that the Trump administration will implement the changes it's been talking about, tax cuts for businesses and relaxed regulation. But that hasn't happened yet.
A lot will depend on what policies, in fact, get pushed through Congress. So if we actually do see tax cuts, if we actually do see significant deregulations, that is when we hope that a lot of this is actually reflecting the long term.
A big difficulty in the economy right now isn't that people can't find jobs. It's that employers can't find workers. And immigration reform could make things harder for some sectors. Mark Zandi is with Moody's Analytics.
Actually, this is going to be our biggest problem going forward. It's not going to be unemployment or underemployment. It's going to be a lack of labor.
This ADP report isn't official. The U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics will put out its jobs report on Friday. Economists and analysts are expecting those numbers to reinforce the optimism small businesses have been experiencing of late. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
All right, so we told you about the CBO yesterday, the Congressional Budget Office, and its role in scoring the GOP's new health care bill. All bills, in fact, and figuring out how much those bills are going to cost. Today in the House, work has begun on what's called marking up the bill, literally marking it up, amending and rewriting as necessary. Committee markup on a bill of this import would normally take weeks or more. Republicans, however, are trying to get it done by Friday. And as Marketplace's Adam Allington reports, you can learn a whole lot about the economics of a bill by paying attention to the markup.
Think of markup as the product testing phase of new legislation. Mark Harkins is with the Government Affairs Institute at Georgetown University.
When Congress is trying to figure out how to find compromise on legislation, they go through this process in committees to make changes to bills, and that's what the markup process is.
The idea with markup, says Harkins, is to amend, rack up votes, and push legislation forward. As far as timing, he says there is precedent for moving quickly.
The National Defense Authorization Act, which authorizes $500 billion, is always done within one day. And so the idea that you want to get this done relatively quickly makes it less likely that people can find fault with it.
In fact, given that some Republicans are already calling the bill Obamacare light, there may be little stomach for a true markup.
The issue is whether you want to have a real markup that's deliberative or if you want to have a markup for markup's sake.
Abby Gluck is director of the Solomon Center for Health Law and Policy at Yale. A telling sign, she says, is the fact that all of this is happening even before the Congressional Budget Office has scored the bill to see how much it costs or how many people might lose insurance.
It's a symbol. It's something that they're showing the American public that they're willing to pass this bill through at any cost, at any speed, without really trying to figure out the implications of the bill on the American public.
While President Obama signed the Affordable Care Act 14 months after entering office, Senate Leader Mitch McConnell said yesterday he wants to send a bill to President Trump before the April recess. I'm Adam Allington for Marketplace.
Elsewhere in capitalism today, way elsewhere, the publisher of the Los Angeles Times and the Chicago Tribune, among other papers, apparently wants a piece of the celebrity magazine industry. Trunk, formerly known as Tribune Publishing, is said to be in talks to buy Us Weekly with a price tag of somewhere near $90 million. What's the play here? Marketplace's Adrian Hill has it.
Celebrity magazines just don't have the same appeal in the grocery store checkout line. Samir Hosni is director of the Magazine Innovation Center at the University of Mississippi.
Maybe we are growing up. Maybe we finally figured out as a country that, you know, there's much more important things for me to do in life than finding out whether Kim Kardashian is pregnant or not.
He's kidding. Closer to the truth, says Hosni, is that we can get more, fresher celebrity news on our phones and computers. I don't have to wait a week to find out that Rob and Black China are back together. Thank you, TMZ. Or that Ben and Jen have called off their divorce. For now, hat tip to People.
The market as a whole for the celebrity weekly had its heydays before the dominance of social media.
According to the Alliance for Audited Media, newsstand sales of Us Weekly have dropped by nearly half in the last 5 years. Other celebrity magazines have also fallen off. So why is Trunk reportedly want in? The company didn't return a request for comment, but media consultant Peter Kreisky says it's likely based on the digital potential of Us Weekly.
I think that that is the only way in which one could justify their interest.
But even then, he says, it's a tricky brand to leverage.
Because it's Us Weekly, and Us Weekly doesn't really sound like a digital brand.
Not when we want our celebrity news right this second. I'm Adrian Hill from Marketplace.
Right now, a little bit up, a little bit down on Wall Street today. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There's a big industry meeting going on down in South Florida this week. The National Confectioners Association, sometimes referred to as Big Candy, is gathering at the Trump National Doral Resort near Miami. At the same time, the group is trying to win some policy points up in Washington with the Trump administration. The Washington Post had the story today. Amy Britton's an investigative reporter there. Amy, it's good to have you on.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
This story, this set of meetings that are happening in South Florida and at the D.C. hotel that Mr. Trump owns, it seems to be right at the nexus of people doing business with companies owned by the president of the United States and at the same time trying to change or influence policy of that government.
Right. I mean, we're kind of really fascinated by that potential intersection between Trump Organization business and the Trump White House.
Tell me then about the National Confectioners Association and what they have to say about these bookings that they made, which we should say they made, you know, two-ish years ago.
Right. So one of the interesting things is that one of my colleagues actually saw the National Confectioners Association back at the Trump International Hotel in D.C. In September, before the hotel was even officially open. So keep in mind, you know, the rooms were still being finished. People are still working on drywall, construction throughout the building. I mean, they were one of the first major groups in the door. But the major thing that has changed is that they are now lobbying the Trump administration for favorable actions related to the candy industry.
What is it that the Confectioners Association wants? What's their lobbying push? Do you know?
Right. So they actually want a lot over the next couple of years. The candy manufacturers and the sugar growers in this country don't really like each other, which I wasn't really aware of. I thought they would all be kind of on the same team. Yeah. You know, sugar goes into candy. The candy manufacturers, they want a complete overhaul of the sugar subsidy program in this country. So if they get what they want when it comes to sugar reform, they're estimating that that could save their industry $280 million a year.
The group would not disclose, the Confectioners Association would not disclose, you say, how much they had paid the Trump Organization, but you did some asking around.
We did, yes. So these bookings are not cheap, but at a minimum, I think we're talking about upwards hundreds of thousands of dollars, possibly approaching or surpassing $1 million, because you're talking about 600 people right now at the Miami Doral Trump Resort. That's a very luxurious resort, you know, spa packages included, golfing excursions, you know, a dessert networking hour at the Donald J. Trump Grand Patio. There's so much Trump branding associated with this convention that it's hard not to look at the, you know, convention packet and say, huh, you know, this is really interesting how you see Trump's name all over this packet. And at the same time, we know that they are aggressively and actively lobbying the Trump administration for what they want.
We ought to note here, and you do in this piece, that right before he was inaugurated, Ms. Trump had a press conference. His lawyer was there, and she said, this will be an arm's length relationship that the president has with his company. He's not going to have anything to do with these transactions, and his adult sons and another executive are going to run the Trump organization. That said, he still does own the company.
Right, he does. And, you know, I don't think anyone necessarily thinks that Donald Trump is receiving a spreadsheet of individuals staying at his hotels every week. But let me tell you this, he's been to the Trump International Hotel in D.C. several times since he was inaugurated. You know, he's been seen there. We've learned that some of his cabinet members are actually living in the hotel during the week in D.C. So there's certainly an appearance that if you go to the Trump Hotel and bring your business there, you could argue that there's a decent shot that you would either run into the president or run into a member of his cabinet or his staff, because they are there quite frequently, and they don't hide it. You know, they put this out in the open whenever they're there. It's a scene. They want to be seen. They're interacting with the customers there.
Amy Britton at The Washington Post. Amy, thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Somali immigrants have been building a community in Minnesota for about 25 years, and now it's the biggest Somali-American population in the country, American citizens and their children, as well as newer immigrants. Somalia, it's important to note here, is one of the six countries named in President Trump's revised travel ban that he signed on Monday. And so, as Minnesota Public Radio's Laura Yuen reports, Somali-Americans are pushing for increased investments in their community while also fighting for their image.
The Somali sambusa, a plump triangle of savory meat and spices, has had a starring role in recent meet and greets at the Minnesota State Capitol. Trays of the fried snack have brought together hungry lawmakers and Somali American leaders, like Republican State Senator Jerry Relf and community advocate Fartoon Welly.
And I think people who want to divide us focus on our differences.
Right.
For the first time, Welly and other community leaders are banding together to make the case for millions of dollars in state funding. The money would go to everything from after-school programs to job training. Welly, whose nonprofit helps Somali women and girls, says the state should invest in her community on things like maternal health and preventative care, rather than trying to fix problems after they emerge.
We have the skills and we know the community. Invest in us and then we can build a community from the bottom up.
The most recent census data indicate that more than half of the state's Somali population is living in poverty. The Somali unemployment rate is roughly 11%. These are sources of pain for the community, but many are emboldened by their growing political muscle. One of those points of pride is newly elected Democratic State Representative Ilhan Omar, who says she's happy to see so many leaders in her community at the Capitol event.
There is a saying in Somali that says, "Farka liget fol mataqdo," which means with just one finger, you're unable to wash your face. And so when we think about what it means for people to collectively work together and how much we can get done, that I think is going to send a signal to the state and the nation.
Minneapolis has also elected Somali Americans to its city council and school board. Yet at the same time, they're more in the national news for concerns about extremism. Nine young men who were raised in Minnesota were recently sentenced for conspiring to travel to Syria to join ISIS. In his recent speech to Congress, President Trump called for better vetting of people entering the country.
We cannot allow a beachhead of terrorism to form inside America. We cannot allow our nation to become a sanctuary for extremists.
Maybe we have the same goals in mind. He hates ISIS and extremism. We do too.
That's Abdurrazak Bihi of Minneapolis. He's been speaking out about the dangers of violent extremism for nearly a decade, ever since his teen nephew was recruited and eventually died fighting for the terror group Al-Shabaab in Somalia. Bihi says Trump needs to understand Somali Americans have come here to escape war and terrorism. He and others want to expand opportunities for young Somali Americans so they feel as if they belong and can climb to the highest levels of civic and political leadership. In St. Paul, I'm Laura Ewan for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think they're just doing it so crooks can be more crookeder and the consumers need protection.
The uncertain future of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 69 points today, about a 1/3%, closed at 20,855. NASDAQ up 3 points, less than a 1/10%, finished at 5837. The S&P 500 down 5 points, 1/4%, 23.62. Falling oil prices and rising U.S. inventories hit energy sector stocks. ExxonMobil off 1.8% today. Chevron down 2%. H&R Block sprinted up 14.9% today. The tax preparer posted third-quarter revenue that beat analyst expectations. Caterpillar burrowed down 2.8%. The New York Times said it had reviewed a government report accusing the equipment maker of carrying out tax and accounting fraud. Caterpillar says it hasn't seen the report and therefore will not comment upon it. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.55%. You're listening to Marketplace. If you want to get smarter about all the things we talk about on this program every single day,
technology, the economy, pop culture, politics, check out our podcast, Make Me Smart.
Molly Wood is my co-host.
Or maybe Kai Rizdahl is my co-host.
I don't know. Maybe. We've got new episodes every week.
And we have live Facebook videos and all kinds of other great stuff for you.
Find us at marketplace.org/makemesmart or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts.
And please follow us on Twitter for more. I am at Molly Wood.
And I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Check it out. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. You'll want to make people in the chicken business nervous? Just whisper avian influenza at them and see what happens. Bird flu, as it's known, can wipe out millions of chickens if it spreads. Countries will ban imports from certain regions or the entire American poultry industry if it gets bad enough. Prices tumble and bad things happen to the bottom lines of chicken farmers. All of which is by way of saying that this past weekend, the H7N9 strain of bird flu was found in Tennessee. Just 75,000 chickens, plus or minus. But still, we figured it was a good time to check in with the chicken farmer that we know. His name is Ed Fryer. He is the CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry in Rogers, Arkansas. Mr. Fryer, it's good to talk to you again, sir.
Hey, good to talk to you again, Kai.
First of all, what was your reaction when you heard about this latest avian flu thing?
Anytime there's an AI outbreak, you get nervous. But this one has been very limited so far, so right now we're not that nervous. But I found out about it about 3 o'clock on Sunday afternoon, and the rest of Sunday and all of Monday were very busy with our AI preparedness.
Yeah, that's funny. You think avian flu. Everybody else thinks artificial intelligence, but that's a whole
thing. Oh, yeah.
That's a whole
or artificial
thing.
Insemination. Yeah. I hadn't thought about that either.
Well, and then there's that from the agriculture guy. What precautions do you take? I mean, how do you protect yourself when this happens?
It's primarily biosecurity. Some of the things we do, any vehicles that go onto a farm, we have to spray all the tires. Any visitors have to wear protective gear. Mm-hmm. That includes, you know, certain plastic boots over their shoes. You've got to wear a jumpsuit, that sort of thing. Truck drivers, feed truck drivers are not allowed to go inside the chicken houses. That's just another level of biosecurity beyond what we normally have on our broiler farms.
So it goes up from there, I imagine. So are you worried or watchful, I guess?
I'm watchful right now.
Yeah.
I think watchful is a good good term. USDA has gotten very good at coming in and controlling these breaks. And if this break is limited to just this one farm, then I don't think it's going to have hardly any impact on the marketplace at all.
You are, as we've said before in this program when we've talked to you, you are an economist, an actual like PhD-trained economist. You are also a guy running a small business in this economy, maybe not so small, getting bigger hopefully every day for you. I would love your sense of what you think of the current political environment in which this economy now is operating.
The I'm a member of a group that meets here in Northwest Arkansas. We meet about once a month. There's about a dozen CEOs of similar size companies to us. And after the election, it was just like night and day in terms of our outlook for our business and all of our businesses. And it's almost, for the last 6 years, it's almost felt like a war on jobs and a war on business. And that feels just the opposite today.
You're hopeful then.
Yeah, much, much more so than I was 6 months ago.
Ed Fryer is the CEO of Ozark Mountain Poultry. We got him in Rogers, Arkansas. Mr. Fryer, thanks very much for your time, sir. We'll talk soon.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Other than Obamacare, which, as we talked about earlier, is deep in the legislative meat grinder right now, perhaps no legacy of the Obama years is more disliked by congressional Republicans than the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. The CFPB, in the vernacular, was created as part of Dodd-Frank, the post-crisis tightening of regulations on the financial industry. And now, with Republicans in charge in Washington, its future, like the Affordable Care Act, is uncertain. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer reports.
Here are the kinds of things the CFPB does. It educates consumers, and it's created new, easy-to-understand mortgage forms. The CFPB also enforces consumer laws on things like fraud. It took the lead in the Wells Fargo case, fining the bank $100 million for opening unauthorized accounts without consumers' knowledge that generated fees for the bank. Tracy Kilgore was ensnared in that scandal.
Oh, I was really angry. I mean, I felt like I was a victim of a crime.
Kilgore says a Wells Fargo employee applied for a credit card in her name without her permission. She joined other consumers in a class action suit against the bank. It wouldn't comment on her case, but Kilgore says the CFPB has been the driving force in holding Wells Fargo accountable, and she doesn't want the agency to be abolished by Congress.
I think they're just doing it so crooks can be more crookeder and the consumers need protection.
Some members of Congress do want to get rid of the CFPB altogether, but the feeling among Congress watchers is Congress wants to change the CFPB, not wipe it out.
Innately, there is nothing wrong with the CFPB.
That's Ed Groshans, an analyst at Height Analytics. He says the problem with the CFPB is the way it's structured. It's basically out of the clutches of Congress.
It's completely independent and outside the control of Congress. And I think for some Republicans, just that structure in and of itself, they don't care for.
Some Republicans want veto power over the CFPB's budget. Right now, it's funded directly by the Federal Reserve, not an appropriation from Congress. Francis Creighton is with the Financial Services Roundtable, a trade association for banks. He's been lobbying for congressional control over the CFPB's budget.
I don't think you ever want to give any agency of any kind a complete blank check.
Creighton also wants Congress to change the leadership of the CFPB. Instead of having a single director, he wants it to be headed by a five-member bipartisan commission. Creighton says that would give banks some stability, so they're not at the whim of a single director. But strong backers of the CFPB, like Democratic Senator Elizabeth Warren, say the CFPB would just get bogged down in political bickering if it were headed by a commission.
Structurally, we need an agency that can move when there's a problem, not an agency that can move after consumers have been cheated for 10 years.
The Republicans who want to make these changes to the CFPB will probably need some support from Democrats, but they can forget about Warren.
I will fight them every inch of the way. Count on it.
As the debate swirls around it, the CFPB is continuing work it started under the Obama administration, including new rules for payday lenders. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
final note on the way out today, which I suspect is true across most of media, but I'll speak only for Marketplace here. This is what we'd have sounded like if our female reporters and producers and editors and executives had stayed home today. That was just 5 seconds, too. Trust me, it's totally true. I should tell you, by the way, I wanted to do 15 seconds of dead air, but my boss, she overruled me. Dow off 69 points today, about a 3%. The NASDAQ up 3 points, less than a 10%. S&P 500 down 5 points, about a 0.25%. Chris Clark, Brad Fisher, Jake Gorski, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Daniel Ramirez, Charlton Thorpe, and Ben Tollett, engineer of the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.